Hi, I'm W2P Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with...
Stephen Tringali, the director and cinematographer of Corridor 4.
And?
Maria Bissell, the producer of Corridor 4.
And the movie is playing Thursday at the Washington West Film Festival in Reston, and also again Sunday also, right? Is that also in Reston on Sunday?
So, yeah, same venue, the Bowtie Cinema at the Reston Town Center.
Okay, cool. And I will be doing the Q&A with these guys for the opening night screening on Thursday, so come check it out, and also be sure to stick around for the Q&A. And also, before we get into what the movie's about, isn't there also a little, there's a band playing before the Q&A, right?
Yes, Isaac Hopi, our main character, plays in a Hawaiian folk band. He's originally from Waianae, Hawaii, and so then when he moved to D.C., he found some friends to play music with, and so then they play Hawaiian folk music. It's mostly like covers of Hawaiian folk songs that they liked when they were growing up.
Awesome. So yeah, it's going to be fun. Everybody come out, and then the party's right after that, and so it's the perfect way to do the opening night. But let's talk about what the movie is actually about. And you guys, I saw an early cut of this a long time ago. In full disclosure, we all know each other from AU Film School, so we go back a few years.
Way back.
Way back. They let me crash on their couch for the Oscars sometimes, maybe. So they're great filmmakers. It's a good local success story, too, if you want to support people that came up through the local, you know, filmmaking community and stuff too. So everybody check it out. But just on its own, it's a great movie here. So let's tell them what it's about. So it's called Corridor 4, which refers to the part of the Pentagon that was hit. So tell them what it's about.
Yes. So the film Corridor 4, we made it basically to kind of challenge the image of kind of the traditional American hero, that someone does something so great and they're praised for it, and that everything else afterward is just wonderful, and they kind of soak in the glory that they received. And really, the truth of it was that all the things that Isaac did, that he was praised for after 9/11 and saving people and being a first responder, he still didn't feel like he had done enough, and he really had, you know, what his friends describe as like survivor's guilt and wondering like what he could have done. And I think this is a common problem that a lot of first responders on that day, and really in any area, afterward.
Firefighters, military, law enforcement,
yeah,
other people involved in those scenarios.
So the film is kind of about everything that he did on September 11th and then basically how him and his coworkers are working toward getting over their sort of feelings of survivor's guilt and the trauma that they experienced and sort of the avenues that they take in order to help them kind of contain those struggles.
Absolutely, let's sort of break it up sort of into pieces, because I in a second I do want to get into you know how his family and his music and everything and his Hawaiian culture, just everything. I mean, that's what you focus on mostly, how that helps him get over the PTSD. But before we get to that piece, just isolate it a little on where he was on the actual day of the tragedy on 9/11, just so our listeners kind of can visualize where he is and what happened on that day.
Right. I believe he was having his dog checked up, and there's like a vet building that's sort of, I believe it's on the property, but it's not a part of the main structure. And so then I believe they got a call about it, and we've kind of took this part out of the film because we felt like it was a little bit too much lead up, but right. Basically it's in the news articles about him. So he gets in his car and he speeds off to the Pentagon, and he pulls up along like close to the building and sees everything that's going on. And so then there's some debate about like what should be done. Should we try to reconvene and take a head count of who's there? Should we just go start going in? Because, you know, no one really knew or had any idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. And Isaac just instinctually decided to just run in there and start pulling people out. And
when everyone else was running away, he's running in.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah. And
in the process, while he was pulling people out, he was also calling out to people because it was so dark in the building that people didn't know how to get out. Right. And there was no emergency lighting. And so he was just calling to people to follow his voice. And that's how a group of people actually made it out and survived, because they were following him calling out to them.
Wow.
And because he has a distinctive Hawaiian voice, they were able to identify him later pretty easily.
Right. Then they know who their hero was. That's so cool.
Yeah.
So obviously, yeah, I mean, I know you guys set the scene with some cool, you know, aerial shots of, you know, of the Pentagon and stuff. But what was really commendable to me is how you made it less of, you know, like there's been a lot of 9/11 documentaries over the last 15 years, right? And, you know, I don't know if audience had fatigue or what, but what I loved about what made your guys' movie different is that, yes, you use that to set the scene, but then you really explore the aftermath and the PTSD he's going through. How did you guys decide to sort of take that angle on it? Because I think that's what makes this unique.
I think if, you know, and this will be easier to understand after seeing the film, but the halfway point of the film is probably what we thought the film was going to be. And then basically, I guess as we were making it, I was sort of looking into other doc filmmakers and looking at their approach. And I remember that Matt Heineman, the director of Cartelland, he would do these interviews and talk about how he had a professor at school that said, if you make a documentary and you end up where you thought you would be, you weren't listening along the way. And so,
right. And it's so, like an interview. It's like anything.
Yeah.
Go with what,
yeah,
what exactly. They're starting to give you.
Yeah, yeah. So we paid a lot of attention to, you know, I had my set of questions for the interview, or Maria and I would like prepare some stuff. And then by the end, we would just kind of let the conversations go where they would. And it started to move in the direction of figuring out that this, like, dealing with the trauma of the event was unexpected. And that they were all kind of like, whether it had been something that they had managed before or whether it was ongoing, those felt like those would be storylines. And that's why some of his coworkers are end up being more prominent characters later in the film, like Don Brennan, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing was at the time I was reading a book that John Krakauer had written called Missoula, Rape in the Justice System in a College Town. And in the book, he talks about how he was motivated to write this book because he had an acquaintance, or it was like a close friend. And he talks about it in the book where he had a close friend who was the victim of sexual assault. And it was not the circumstance that he thought it was. He imagined that, like, someone who was a victim of sexual assault would be like walking in the street and someone in a like black clothing would like jump out with a mask, you know, and, right, and attack them. And it wasn't that, it was a friend who had done that. And he did more research on it and realized that there was all this information that he didn't really realize or understand about sexual assault that went against stereotypes that probably are perpetrated mostly in the media. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the way that we felt when we started learning about people dealing with traumatic situations and how does PTSD develop and like kind of where the, you know, like, how do you manage things like that? I guess me and Maria kind of felt like we were wrong
in what we thought we knew.
Right. And part of it, too, that's a stumbling block is you think, like, I went to college. I took all these college courses. I should be educated. Why do I not know about this?
Right.
And that was the motivation to think, like, if we don't, you know, we should do a better job of depicting this.
Right. What you mentioned that the current midpoint is where you thought it was going to go. What is that? What is that in the movie now?
Well, I can tell you, and I guess I can, you can cut it out if you
sure.
want. It's where we realize that it's like a big reveal that Wayne Sinclair is the guy he saves. And the thing, it was a debate of whether to set it up like a reveal because we thought there's news articles about it. And like, wouldn't people know about this already? But I realized
not
that.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, exactly.
Most people, yeah.
I forget what other movies we watched that we thought, man, this was a big news story and how, but they had cut it in such a way that it was like, I heard one doc editor describe it as like the slow trickle of information, that it's very important to not just give everything up at the beginning.
The old slow disclosure.
Yeah. So we build up to this reveal that, like, we think it's going to solve his problem. Isaac has all these regrets, and his family describes it as being difficult because he feels like he has survivor's guilt. And then here we show that this Washington Post reporter is able to connect the dots and find that here's this guy that followed someone's voice out, and it turns out that it's Isaac, and that it's this big relief for him.
That these people he couldn't physically get to, he was still able to save in some capacity.
By his voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's where you thought it was going to build
to
eventually.
Yeah, that it'd be like
originally.
A big success story of like, he was sad, but then it was solved and it was great. And
so then what did you discover that took you beyond that, you think? Just that there was still a lot more he was grappling with even beyond that?
Yeah, his family would say things that would allude to underlying problems that, you know, maybe they were still trying to figure out whether it had been dealt with or not. And
other officers, too, saying that they were still dealing with their feelings of regret and trauma and getting through it.
Yeah.
And we thought that they had all been fine and we were wrong. So.
And and I think in a way too, and it's not by any fault of the coverage surrounding it, because in a way they're just trying to give credit where credit's due. They want to write a good story about someone and say, look, this is a wonderful thing that you did. And isn't it awesome that Wayne got saved?
Finding something uplifting.
Yeah,
in a
exactly.
Day.
Yeah. But then I think what no one really probably anticipated was just that, you know, maybe no amount of praise was going to change, you know, because they have very high expectations for themselves and what they can do. And it's not going to necessarily make them feel like the people that did die, you know, were that they just wanted to save those people too. So, yeah, so that's basically when we started, you know, someone would tell us something like Don would say, oh, my daughter did an interview for me. You know, she was in journalism school at the time and she interviewed her dad right after September 11th. And it's in the Library of Congress, you know, and the Library of Congress has a website where you can go and find all these things. And so we went and listened to the interview. And in it, you can hear, it's very interesting because you can hear the internal debate, because there's a guy that he thinks survived, but he's not sure, but he, but due to circumstances, because he was the only person who had a radio, like he had to leave this guy and let some other people take care of him. But he always wondered, like, what happened to this guy?
And whether or not he survived.
Right.
Yeah. And I thought it was such a good illustration in real time of probably a debate that a lot of people have in their heads about. And other officers like Irwin Weston, who's unfortunately not in the film, but he'll be at one of the Q&As, he was telling us that he's had this long career in emergency services, and he was just saying that some nights he would just sit up and replay the event and think, like, if I'd only done this or gone this way, or like maybe this person would have been, you know, and you think this is a lot of pressure to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. How did you, take me back a second. How did you guys actually discover Isaac Story and meet him? Like, what was the connection that said, oh, we know him and, oh, this might make a movie?
Yeah, so my family has known him for a long time, since before September 11th. He coached my little sister in softball, and Gigi and my mom became best friends.
And Gigi is?
Gigi is Isaac's wife, and they all go on, like, cruises together and whatnot, and they've kept close even though his daughter, Kukana, and my little sister aren't close anymore.
Right. Softball days are over.
Yeah. So we've known him for so long. I remember knowing how happy and jovial and giving he is as a human. When we heard about what he did on September 11th, we all thought, like, oh, that's so Isaac. Of course he would run into a building and save people. And that's part of my surprise was sitting at my kitchen table with Gigi later, talking about, I was in eighth grade at the time, I think, telling her how cool it was that we had this hero that we knew that I could brag about to my friends. Right. And she kind of put me back in my place and said, you know, he still is really sad about all the people he didn't save. And he still feels like he didn't do enough because he didn't get hurt. And that blew my mind at the time. Like, I couldn't wrap my head around it. And then making the documentary, of course, it kind of came up again. But we've known him for a long time, since, like, we've seen, like, the before and after Isaac, if you will. Mm-hmm. And when I went to film school, my mom kept saying, if you're going to make a movie about anyone, you should make it about Isaac. And because I know him pretty well, I was able to just kind of call him up and say, so we want to make a movie. Are you cool with that? And he's like, sure, why not? Whatever you need. Like, he's just very accommodating. So that's how it started. And then I was terrible at directing it because I knew him as an adult always. No matter how old I'll get, he'll always be an adult to me. Right. And so I was very shy about asking certain questions, and Steve was not. So he took over.
Awesome. So then take me into the sort of, I guess, some more of the, how you mentioned there was the, you knew the before and the after Isaac. So I guess describe a little of that a little bit. In what way did he change afterwards? I'm sure it sounds like he's still sort of the jovial guy, but
for sure.
In which ways do you think is forever shaped by that? And how does that sort of play, like, come across on screen too?
I think he was always, you can see it in home video footage that we put in the documentary. He's such, like, a jokester, and before, he still is, but way more than, and he just didn't seem to take things very seriously. Like, he didn't seem to take life seriously in a way that he was always just very fun-loving.
Right.
And afterward, you can just tell that he has more quiet, thoughtful, serious moments. Mm-hmm. That he's not necessarily a sad person now. He's just...
I'd say he's wiser.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
And he... And it's very clear that he values and loves the time with his family mm-hmm. a lot more than in a more like meaningful way than mm-hmm. I think he did 20 years ago.
Yeah. Right?
And I think part of it is mostly due to the fact that in a way, you know, family and his Hawaiian culture, I think were very key in making sure that the trauma he experienced did not get out of hand. And I think that's maybe the most important part of this film that I hope people take away is just having an understanding that. So before this, I feel like we felt like PTSD was something you saw in films and that it was usually a war veteran who had like violent outbursts and
like a flashback,
a drinking problem.
Wakes up from a nightmare and sweats, that kind of thing.
And that somehow, because it was an image that was repeated over and over and over again,
right.
It became the thing, the only thing that people understood as like, this is the image of PTSD. And
right.
Either that's you, or if you don't have that, then whatever, you're not
right.
Dealing with it. And so basically we felt like, at first, we didn't realize that that was what was going on until we had a feedback screening with some friends. And one of our friends' feedback was just like, why? We need to see some of these guys like maybe throwing things or yelling. And I thought, I was trying to figure out, because we try to dissect everybody's comments and think.
Right. Like, why is he asking that?
Yeah, exactly. Where does this question come from?
Because it's and then so not Isaac. He would never do something
right.
like that.
Yeah.
And then we had to think about it in the broader cultural sense of like what's on TV, what's in the media, what's shaping our ideas of the things right. in the film. And then that's sort of when we dug a little deeper and realized that we have this image that we need to kind of get rid of and show that, yes, like there are definitely people that's the reaction and it's a completely legitimate thing. But it isn't necessarily the view of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the important part too is to show that like, the one, Dr. Elspeth Cameron Ritchie, she works at the VA hospital in dealing with trauma like this. Mm-hmm. And she talks a lot in the film about how it's totally normal to have feelings like this following a traumatic event. It's what anybody's normal reaction would mm-hmm. be, to feel sad or depressed or maybe have a hard time like moving through your life normally. But the distinction is that if it impairs your life for, you know, beyond this time frame, that's when it kind of turns into PTSD.
Yeah.
And it's a heavy thing to be told that that's what you have. And so there's a way, like, to be honest, I never say that about Isaac because he's never been, you know, he's never gone to a doctor and been diagnosed. And
right.
I think it'd be unfair for me to say specifically, like, Isaac has it because
right.
in a way, he, like, the thing that helps take you from like avoiding that shift from this is my body reacting to this traumatic situation mm-hmm. to okay, it's impairing my life and I can't get on is there's all these factors that can help you avoid that. And some of the things are things that I think Isaac was lucky enough to have in his life. And those are his family support system. You know, in the film, Gigi says like, I knew that I needed to get Isaac back on track. And his family cared enough to see that he was behaving differently, that he was quieter than usual and that he wasn't playing music anymore, and they wanted to put him back on track. And then also too, like the Hawaiian community in the DC area is very much a part of him playing music. And then on top of that, he works at the canine unit. And so and animal therapy is one of those things that, you know, Dr. Ritchie talks about where she yeah. says there's like kind of three buckets of treatment, which is, you know, medication or talk therapy, or this other category, which kind of is like yoga, acupuncture, working with horses and dogs.
Animals, yeah.
Yeah, art therapy.
Yeah.
And so
he was lucky enough that he was already kind of working in that.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I think in a way, like Isaac has all these things. He's so lucky to have all these things in his life that allowed him
to cope with that. Yeah.
But and I think his music.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But I think you'll see in the film that there's, you know, that this was not necessarily the case for all of his coworkers, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I think too, if you look at, you know, anybody that you might know in your life, like you, not everybody has like is as outgoing of a person, for instance, as Isaac, and doesn't necessarily have the multitudes of friends that right. someone like Isaac might
the
have.
The support system.
Right. Yeah. And those are the people I think that I hope someone watches this film and realizes that maybe they have a friend who might not necessarily call them up and say, like, hey, let's go out and chat.
Right.
And maybe it will make that person realize that if, let's say that someone they know is going through a hard time, but maybe they're not terribly social, that they would extend that grace to them and say, hey, look, like, you know, just come over and, I don't know, do whatever. But that social component is a key thing, I think, in helping people overcome situations like this.
Absolutely. You're talking a lot about how, you know, his family and, you know, his life here and then also his Hawaiian culture. But take our listeners into the idea of what production looked like. Like, how much did you shoot over there? How much did you shoot here? You know, how many total days you shot? That sort of stuff.
How many total days?
Logistical stuff.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. I think that the shoot itself was like maybe just over 50 days.
Okay.
And
like actual shooting days, but that's spread out over. Yeah.
Of course, yeah, spread out over like about a year. But of course, this didn't include the time that we spent like preparing for it or cutting the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did what? It was 2/3 of it was in DC, and then the other third was in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we filmed a bunch of interviews and B-roll in DC first, then went and edited a little. Then went to
Hawaii,
and then went back to DC because we finally got permission to film at the Pentagon.
Right.
So we came back and we did the Pentagon, some more Smithsonian filming, and some more interviews. And the majority of interviews, well, it was kind of 50-50 between the two DC trips, would you say? Because family and then the coworkers.
Yeah,
because there were, well...
And
so
where does he live? Where in DC?
He's in Fairfax.
Fairfax.
Yeah, I believe.
So he was in McLean, and in the middle of the movie and shooting, they moved to Vienna.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Vienna. But they had been in McLean forever, right. And so their move was kind of only like a recent thing.
Yeah.
Sure. Gotcha. Okay. So that gives us an idea of how long it took to shoot. How, you know, give us, in case there's some really, you know, film buff people here, but, you know, sort of the type of camera you use, that sort of stuff.
Oh, sure.
How many people you had on a crew, which I'm sure is mostly you guys.
Yeah. No, it was very tiny.
Yeah.
I mean, so before shooting, it would basically just be me and Maria. And we would be the, like, just figuring out the logistics. Like, Maria would be, well, you can talk about what.
I handled a lot of, like, locations would mm-hmm. probably be my big thing. So figuring out, all right, you need to film on a microfiche. I'm going to find a place that has a microfiche who will let us film there, which ended up being the Fairfax Library, or getting in touch with the Smithsonian and getting permission, and even talking to the Pentagon when it finally came down to it. With when we got permission, they sent us the filming agreement, and I had to then go through it and figure out what we were getting into. And then you were mainly talking to the interview. I helped with some of the interview scheduling, but you were talking to a lot of those people to just figure out those like times. And we were going back and forth about what it was basically creating the shooting schedule as we went and when people were available.
Right.
And when we were on set, it was Steve, a camera assistant who was the operator during
the
actual interviews that Steve could just focus on talking to whoever he was talking to, and a sound guy and a line producer. So sometimes it was me. Sometimes I couldn't be there because of work, and we would have someone else go to basically get releases signed and make sure logistically everything was there. One of our sound guys called me the mom PA, where I made sure everyone was fed and got where they needed to on time, but I was also every department's PA, so I was kind of like an all-hands-on-deck overseer.
Mom
PA.
Orange slices after the game.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's hilarious. What about, directing it, and also since you're working cinematographer as well, what camera did you use? And take us sort of more into, like, because we talk about, like, what the story is about, but just sort of visually how you crafted a look and how you wanted to visually approach this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so we used, I own, like, one of the earlier versions of the Red camera, and I've held on to it because basically... sometimes I'll get called for very small indie films to shoot them, and they don't have enough budget to like go to a rental house. And so I'm like, all right, well, this. And the thing is, even though it's, I don't know, it's just so funny. Like, from a technology standpoint, I think that most cameras at this stage, they all look really good. It's the variable factor here is how well do you know how to use,
right,
like, just an image-making tool.
Right.
So we used that because we had already invested the money in having it, so we avoided the cost of renting more stuff.
Sure.
So then I guess as far as crafting a look, I think at first I thought that this film, and this kind of goes back to like needing to listen the whole way and ending up
the
in
Matthew
a new place.
Heineman thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who was sitting in your chair, by the way, for AFI Doc. So Tringalian, Heineman, and Bissell, I mean, are now all in the same chairs. Breath.
Yeah, if only we could be as good a filmmaker as he is.
Yeah.
We all, you know, something to aspire to, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You guys are close. I think you're there.
I don't know. I don't know if I'd feel comfortable making a movie like Cartel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Never do that.
But visual look, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So at the beginning, the influences were a little different. I would say that we were thinking of the film as being a more structured thing because we thought, up until the halfway point, basically, like, a lot of the film had technically taken place in the past. So how do you represent this and still make it feel present and exciting for somebody to watch? And so we were looking at films like The Imposter or any Errol Morris.
That was a great doc.
Yeah.
A great doc.
And I noticed one thing that we borrowed from The Imposter was all the interviews are framed in a really particular way. And so, like, essentially, the camera gets closer the more important these people are to the central character, which is, I'm blanking on his name now, but the guy who's the imposter.
The imposter guy, yeah.
And his interview, and so all of them are also framed in a way where, like, where they live is kind of part of the interview framing. That it adds some flavor to who they are. And
it's
so,
not just in some random room. You're using the
backdrop. Exactly. So like the sister or the mom, you're in their house and you think like, oh, okay, I'm getting the setting now. And
even subconsciously that affects you as a viewer.
Yeah.
Yes.
You feel like you know something about it, even if it's not, you know, you're just kind of soaking it in as you're listening to them talk.
Yeah. Whereas the imposter's interview was against like kind of a patterned backdrop and he was dead center and the camera was much closer. Mm. And so we kind of took that thinking, you know, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area, it has a specific feel and look. And so I thought we should interview all the people somewhere in their house. Mm-hmm. So we can kind of get a sense of like the feeling of the environment of what it's like to be in this area of the country. Mm-hmm. But for Isaac, we did the like camera's dead center on him. It's a tighter shot and the backdrop is not supposed to matter, you know?
I see.
And then again with Errol Morris
that
too.
That visually makes it, that distinguishes him from the other people you're seeing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think no one's ever mentioned it to me, which makes me think that it did what it was supposed to do, which is just be like a subtle thing that kind of mm-hmm. moves you a little bit more in one direction as mm-hmm. a viewer. But then the rest of the film became more of like a verite exercise because we were filming things like as they were happening in that we were following him around at work.
Some and ride-alongs in the car.
Yeah, yeah. And then also, you know, visiting some of his coworkers at their home because some of them had retired. And so we'd go and visit them and be like, hey, show us this thing. Or because they all kind of keep memorabilia from the time period in a, you know, somewhere in their home. So they would.
Yeah, they all have a box or of some sort, whether it's a box of items or a wall of photos. Even people who say that they can't go back to the building, literally have pieces of the rubble they hold on to. And it's just very interesting to see what each person has in their box, if you will, of that day and how they remember it.
But I think it's their way of feeling like they have control over the situation. Because if they can put it away and say that, like, I survived this and here's the stuff from that day.
Yeah.
It's, I think it gives them a sense of more control over it.
Yeah. Literally compartmentalizing.
Yeah.
Box.
Yeah. Yeah. So wow. The film opens up with one of the first scenes is Isaac opening up one of his boxes that Gigi mainly put together and put like scrapbooks of all the newspaper clippings. And I'm sure that that was her way of memorializing everything that was good about it for their family. But yeah, it kind of opened up of like he's at the beginning of the film opening up this box of 9/11.
And the viewers are watching
exactly.
the contents of this.
Yeah. So it seemed very fitting that it's Isaac opening up the box and then like, all right, now let's go through the box is the film, basically.
Yeah. It's a cool way to structure it. That's I like that. All right, so that's how you shot it and how long it took. But take me into post-production. So you end up with how many hours of footage, and how do you go about starting to weed through that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, I don't know if we came up with
an hour
count, yeah, but yeah. I know.
How many gigabytes?
We did.
Terabytes?
I think we shot.
How many terabytes?
Yeah.
I think we. How many hard drives did this sucker have?
I remember how many cards we shot. Yeah. I think it was just over 200.
Wow.
And the cards would either be like 45 minutes or maybe an hour and a half. Wow. So there was a lot at the end. It went through a bunch of phases. I mean, basically, Maria and I made like an assembly edit. So it was all on the longer side, and I think we didn't have everything that we had filmed just yet. And then we brought on a friend of ours, Brad Allgood, who we all went to school with him.
Also American University.
Yes, and Brad worked on this really incredible.
What's up, Brad?
Yeah. Brad worked
on
this.
We miss you.
Yes. Yes. He's in LA currently.
Well, I miss you. You guys just see him all the time.
We don't
He's
see
sick
him
of
enough,
you guys
but
already. Yeah.
But Brad edited and co-directed this really incredible film called Landfill Harmonic, and we had seen it, and then we were just thinking of who should we ask that we feel comfortable, you know, working with, who's also going to lend this extra level of storytelling to it. And of course, you know, we immediately thought of Brad. And so then Brad worked on it with us for a few months before we went back and shot basically the missing pieces that we needed. And that was probably the most transformative part of the story, because, I mean, it turned into something that we didn't think it was going to at first, I guess, because of some of the choices he was making. And they were all good choices.
Yeah. He pushed us to get to a place in the edit that we were too shy to do before, or wasn't sure how manipulative it might feel as far as chopping up lines and having jump cuts in the middle of someone's interview. And if it'd be distracting or not. And he just went full force into it, and we decided it wasn't bad, and so we embraced it.
Sort of having that set of outside eyes to see the forest for the trees, help you, you know, tell you what's worth keeping or which of your babies you might have to lose, that kind of thing.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And then we finished the pickups, and then I think Brad had to move on to another project, but he had kind of imparted all the wisdom that he could, which is great because we were able to just kind of ingest that wisdom and then start making some more aggressive decisions with the edit and trying to just hone in on the center of the story. Mm-hmm. And so then at that stage, what helped a lot was we basically would cut a version of the film, gather some friends together, have them watch it, and then just hear their feedback. Mm-hmm. And I remember at first we thought, maybe this is a bad idea because it was just hard to hear, you know, that, oh, this isn't that good. But ultimately,
people saying opposite things, and you're like, well, how am I supposed to take all
take?
Of that feedback?
Because
you're telling me the opposite.
Yeah.
It's conflicting.
Yeah.
And so we'd go at it and think, wow, this is the best cut. This is really good. Yeah. And then you'd sit through a screening and think, oh man, we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
But ultimately it was for the better. And I think that it's something that we would probably do into the future on other projects.
Oh, absolutely. Because there were scenes that we thought, like especially the Verite stuff, we would let it play out really long. We thought it was very poetic and interesting. And it would be a 10-minute long scene. Everyone would keep pushing us, cut it down, cut it down, cut it down. And eventually it would become a 2-minute long scene, sequence.
Right, yeah.
Which is better. It's better for having slimmed down, for sure.
Yeah.
But even like the getting into more of the nitty gritty of the edit, it was a lot of Steve going through the interviews and intertwining them in each kind of sequence of like, okay, let's have all the officers and experts talking about PTSD. And he pulled quotes from each person and put it together while I was off in the other corner taking all the Verite stuff and editing those down into what I thought was a scene.
So you kind of did different rough assemblies for each, I guess, category of stuff you shot.
And then we would kind of pass the edit files back and forth and cut into each other's work further and then argue about why what the other person was doing was wrong. And
should have just made for some fun nights on the home
Oh,
front.
For sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Lots of arguments.
Yeah.
But
well, and we did this too, probably not at the wisest time. We did this while simultaneously planning our wedding.
Yeah.
So there were wedding arguments and then edit arguments.
Documentary arguments.
All at once.
Yeah. But if we could do that,
our reception needs to be verite. You're like, no, oh, wait a minute. No, that's the other
wrong
thing.
One. Yeah. It was a very emotional process, but if we can make it through that as a couple, I feel like we can keep going through a lot of things. So it was a good test. Like, can you stay married if you can make a documentary together?
Yeah, see, all you other couples out there that are complaining about how hard it is just to plan a wedding, imagine shooting a documentary while doing your wedding.
Yeah.
Steve and Maria can do it. Yeah. Well, I'm just proud of you
Wouldn't
guys.
Recommend
just
it.
Personally and professional level, like, I'm just so happy for you guys. So, again, everybody, it's making its world premiere at the Washington West Film Fest on Thursday. I'll be there for the Q&A. Also, stick around for Isaac. He'll be there during the Q&A, and also his band will be there performing as well. Mm-hmm. And then it'll play again Sunday in case you guys miss it. But don't miss the opening night. Come out to that first. Just sort of in closing, if people have been listening to this interview and they say, oh, that sounds like an interesting doc, this interesting festival, why should they come out and sort of, what do you hope their takeaway is after they sit through your movie on Thursday and the Q&A, like going out back out into the world, like what do you hope they'll have been affected and changed by seeing your movie?
I think, first of all, Isaac's story is, though it's full of hardship, I think it's a really, ultimately, like a warm, feel-good story, because at the end, I hope that it seems hopeful, because at the end, it's like a story of how, the love between him and his family was so great that he was able to kind of move past this traumatic situation that he experienced. And also, too, I feel like he's such a good... every time we would be with him, I would just be reminded of, that we could all try a little harder to be nicer, kinder people. And then on the other side, the more sort of informational side is that I just hope that people have a broader understanding of the range of what PTSD can look like. And also understanding that there's different shades to how people deal with their trauma. And therefore, there's different ways that they need to find healing or treatment for it. And that I hope that we give them a good cursory understanding of it and that it might kind of change their internal thinking about what it might look like or how to help somebody or how to recommend help for them.
Do you have anything you want to add, Maria? Very good.
Yeah, just to have empathy for those people in a way that you wouldn't have had before, because I know that that's how I feel in this whole process, that I have more empathy and understanding going forward.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks for opening up Isaac's box in the movie and then coming up here and opening up your box. Like, what's in the box? So, thank you so much. It was great. Again, everybody, it's called Corridor 4 World Premiere. Don't miss it. Thursday and also, again, Sunday at the Washington West Film Fest. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Congrats.
Thanks.